So today, it was a really slow trip into the radio station, and I was listening to your Nomad Part 1. And oh my God, I just like got lost in it. It was so fabulous. It's just amazing. It just really blew me away.
You.
Yeah, really cool.
It's cool as well, because I'm doing like this, like I do trailer albums, you know, in between projects and stuff. Whenever I get some downtime, I do some library for a trailer company. And you know, I like the entirety of my last year was writing for kids films. So I went from like a really hybrid aggressive composer to like a really whimsical John Williams-y melodic composer. Oh, not John Williams, more like John Powell, I suppose. But like, so like I delivered this album. And it's all like big melodies and themes and stuff. And he's like, what is this? What is it? So it looks like Nomad Part 2 will be coming soon. Because I have all this music I've written that no one wants.
Well, we've been rolling this whole time, but I will just say that this is Music Respawn, and I'm Kate Remington here with composer Daniel James, and we met at GDC, and it's really so fun to be able to have a chance to just kind of pick up where we left off. So thanks a lot. It's great to have a chance to talk with you.
Yeah, I do apologize if we cover some already treaded ground, Kate.
No, it's okay.
I talk a lot. You see, that's the problem at GDC. I threw all this information at you already, so you'll know half of what I'm going to say already.
Yeah, but that was just for me. So now it's for, you know, anybody who wants to drop by and listen. Mm. And so I thought it was really cool that the thing that kind of got you thinking about writing music for games was playing one of the early Metal Gear Solid games. And I would love to know what it was about Harry Gregson Williams's music that just like kind of punched you in the chest and made you think that this was the thing you could do.
I tell you what, I was at an impressionable age. I'd played the first Metal Gear, and you know, like I loved it like most people did. It was around the time when the PlayStation 2 was new, you know, so I was excited, you know, I loved video games and all that. And I remember going to like the supermarket and seeing a magazine on the shelf, and it had a VHS tape, sellotape to the front back when that was a thing.
Yeah.
And the whole tape was literally just the trailer for Metal Gear Solid 2. And I was like, okay, you know, like I loved Metal Gear, I get that. Got home, threw it in the player. And it like it starts up, and I don't know if you've seen the trailer. It's like 10 minutes long,
yeah,
you know, like you can't get away from 10 minute trailers that much these days. But Metal Gear managed to hold it. And, you know, the trailer starts up and it's got all this weird music, you know, atmospheric. And I'm like, this was a time when video games went from kind of having, you know, the music was, I think the PlayStation 1 allowed them to, you know, play real music back. But mm-hmm. like it was still done very synthetic and, you know, lots of synthesizers, which, you know, has its own form today, you know, like in chiptune music and all that kind of thing. But the PS2 is when companies started hiring orchestral composers to do, you know, the big grand sweeping scores. Anyway, so the trailer starts up and, you know, like I'm all intrigued. And then the main theme of Metal Gear Solid 2 just kicks in. And it was the first time I'd ever noticed that music was having an impact on me. There was something about the music marrying up against that picture, and it just an overwhelming type feeling. And I knew from that moment I wanted to work on Metal Gear. I didn't know at the time it was going to be in music. I just had that oddly specific, bizarre goal of working on a Metal Gear game one day. You know, I tried programming and all that, realized I'm really crap at maths. But anyway, so you know, I tried doing all the programming and stuff, and I was bad. And then, you know, I started doing music because I was in a band when I was younger. So, you know, like we'd play all the thing. And I was always the one, like in the band, who would record our songs on the computer. So I learned to use computers. And then I realized that I could emulate Harry Gregson Williams, with all these. I'll be honest, it sounded nothing like Harry Gregson Williams back then. In fact, I'm ashamed of what it sounded like back then. But, you know, like back then, I the concept of being able to create music like that Metal Gear Solid 2 game, you know, it just appealed to me and I started writing. And then actually my first ever composing gig, which is actually when I start considering, you know, that's the beginning of my career, was on a Metal Gear Solid fan film.
Wow.
Like Metal Gear drove my whole career. I'm not ashamed of that fact, but it's just funny how like all my milestones seem to hit around a Metal Gear theme. But yeah, so it was, yeah, like back to your question though, like there was just Harry Gregson Williams has a very melodic sensibility about the way he writes, and it's very the score to Metal Gear Solid 2, that the theme of it was based on the original one, but it was so it took a theme that I knew very well, very intricately, and then, you know, rearranged it and arranged it in a big sweeping orchestral, you know, and that had a big impact on me. That's why I chose to go down the orchestral route. When I started out, I was not very good at the orchestra. That's why I'm a hybrid composer. I actually started with like sound design and synths and stuff. But I'm getting way ahead of myself. I told you, Kate, I talk so much. You have to just interject and stop me at some point.
I'll do my best.
I'll just go for hours.
No, this is cool. And what is so cool about it is that you did end up working on Metal Gear Solid 5 with Harry Gregson Williams kind of overseeing the whole
yep.
composing team, right? So what was it like to actually be working with him?
It was surreal. I'll give you that. It was interesting. It's when I started my career, I think it was because I so specifically knew what my goal in my career was, it made it somehow easier to attain, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because, you know, my whole career was based around one day I want to work on Metal Gear. You know, it was so specific. And, you know, I'm a firm believer of, you know, following your gut kind of thing. And the fact that I knew what my goal was, every time I was doing something, whether it be working on a project or writing a piece of music, I knew which direction to go. I know this isn't the question you asked. I told you I go off topic. I'll get back to it. But I'd be working on a project and my gut would be saying this is the wrong thing to do. And that's just my subconscious telling me that it's getting me further away from my goal. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So having Harry, you know, Harry Gregson Williams overseeing a project, you know, it was a bizarre, surreal feeling. I didn't expect actually is that it got to a point in my career where I considered myself a professional composer, and the funny thing was is it as I was working on it I was like, oh, this is just me doing my job. If that makes sense, like this is no different from the last few. You know, I'm gonna try my best, I'm gonna give the directors what they want, I'm gonna, you know, give it everything, you know, produce new sounds, all these kinds of things. So that was actually the biggest surprise. You know, I thought that like, you know, some sort of golden angel would appear and, you know, it would be something unique. But it like that was one thing I realized is that and it's, you know, almost as if anybody's listening who's like beginning composing, is that like the job kind of feels the same from beginning to end, you know? So if you enjoy it at the beginning, you'll enjoy it at the professional. If you don't enjoy it at the beginning, you know, it's going to be the same when you're working, just with more pressure on you.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, so, you know, it was a great thing. I tell you what though, Kate, when I finished it, I was lost for like a month. Like I had no idea what to do after I'd done Metal Gear, because that was my whole career.
Yeah.
You know, like I was always aiming for this thing. I thought that was a super ambitious, like I'm never going to attain that, you know, like one of those moments. And then I did it. And then afterwards I was like, oh crap, what do I do now? You know? And I was lucky because just after that, I got a call from Lorne Balfe, and he was, you know, he needed some help with hybrid production on Terminator. So, you know, I didn't have long before I was, you know, back up and working again. But there was a month there where I thought it was all over, Kate. I thought it was all done.
Oh, man. Well, yeah. I mean, it's like you get to the top of Everest and then you look around and it's like, okay, well, yeah, now what?
So, are you saying the only way is down, Kate?
No, not at all.
Is that what you're trying to...
When you were working on Metal Gear and kind of figuring out what it is that's really unique about Harry's sound, I talked with Gordy Hebb a while back about working on Star Wars, and he said he really had to sort of deconstruct what makes John Williams' music for Star Wars sound like that. And did you end up having to do the same thing with the Metal Gear music?
well, to be honest, I think Harry Gregson Williams' sound was always intrinsically part of my sound.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, because he had such an influence on me when I began, you can't stop it from filtering into your sound. And, you know, I do live streams, and I did a big old thing about this the other day. I was saying to my audience, I was like, you know, you shouldn't shy away from your influences, because there's no such thing as original thought. So as a composer, like, nobody, like, and even the Metal Gear people, they don't want, they wouldn't have asked me to emulate Harry Gregson Williams, because they've already hired Harry Gregson Williams. You know what I'm saying? So they don't need me to sound like him, because they've already got him. As a composer, this is what I was saying to my chat room, is that you just need to spend time defining what makes you you. And that is going to be based on, like, it's a culmination of all your influences. It's all your influences piled together, and your subconscious brings those in. And when you compose, it draws from all these different places where you've heard things that have had an emotional impact on you, if that makes sense. So when you're writing, you know, you'll play a note, you know, you'll play a little progression or something, and it'll either feel right or feel wrong. If it feels right, it means your subconscious is saying, we've heard something like this before that had an emotional resonance with us in the past. So, you know, we know that it will work because it worked on us, you know? So when it came to like working on Metal Gear with Harry, they didn't need to ask me to, you know, emulate his aesthetic or something, because it was already kind of intrinsically part of what I do anyway. You know, I wouldn't consider myself a Harry Gregson Williams clone or anything along those lines, but I, like, part of my you know, my ability is, you know, understanding what makes his music work for Metal Gear, and I can write music that's completely different but still works. You know, it still has the same through line. You know, you can put them side by side and they both still represent aesthetically Metal Gear.
One of the toughest things about composing for games, but also for films, because you have to get that unique sound that's like instantly identifiable with a particular property. So how do you come around? I mean, where do you start with something like that?
With coming up with a unique sound?
Yeah,
that's always tricky. I mean, that's every project ever. You know, it's like you have to sound... You have to be completely unique and original, and, you know, everybody has to love it. I think if you saw Mick Gordon's talk at GDC,
was incredible.
You know, it's so true. You know, every time you work, it's like, we need it to be something we've never heard before, you know, completely unique, and has to be loved instantly. How do you come up with that? It really is trial and error. I mean, I find that most composers, I know I definitely am, are reactive composers. You know, we look at what someone else has done and we can interpret that musically. So, you know, a lot of the time that'll help. You know, you get given a script or, you know, like a design document, something like that, before you start. That can help direct where you go. But it really is a case of just, you know, figuring out what it is. You know, you kind of have to trial and error. You have to try things out. So the way I do it is I will break it down into English words that I can understand. You know, like, if I have nothing to work from, no concept art, no images, I just break it down. So this is what the film's about. You know, it's going to be dark. It's going to be moody, aggressive. There's going to be drama. There's going to be sadness. And I can take all these key words and I, you know, you can, if you say dark, aggressive and sadness, you can already imagine all the, like, John Williams music, you know, going out the window, you know, all the big heroic fanfares and things like that. So that narrows it down. And it is just a case of narrowing down in real human terms, you know, like not musical terms, but breaking down emotionally what it needs to be, if you get me there. So yeah. It's like, you know, you just keep chipping away at it, and then eventually you arrive, even if you don't have the melody yet, if you can get the tone or you can get the feeling of the piece, you know, like it, I always start with the main theme, even, you know, even if there's not going to be a main theme in the piece, you know, in the film, mm-hmm. I will always start with what I call a main theme track, which if I don't instantly have a melody, I'll just get the tone right, and I'll find that the melody kind of will come out of that eventually during the process of writing, you know, and I can kind of shoehorn it in, almost like not as crudely as that sounds, but like, you know, I it will find itself. You just have to keep breaking it down and narrowing down on what it actually is. But like I say, most composers are reactive, so you know, you give a composer a concept piece, you know, concept piece of art of what the game looks like, you can see what the director and the art director and the team have already aesthetically chosen as the tone of, you know, whatever the film is, and then you can look at that and you feel it musically. That definitely helps, but in terms of coming up with a unique one, you really just have to keep trying until you nail it. That's one of the harder parts of the job, I'd say.
Yeah, I would imagine. And that's what was so fascinating about listening to part one of Nomad, because every single one of those tracks, I could totally hear in a game. I could visualize them in a game, and they were all so different. You know, some of them were like for epic landscapes, and others were like really creepy, you know, sort of forest stone fields or whatever. But each one of them was so evocative. And did you have games in mind when you wrote them, or were they just kind of like thinking out loud?
The funny thing is a lot of those tracks I actually wrote whilst I was live streaming. So I had like an audience watching while I was doing it. And I would just say to them at the start, I'd say, find me an image off the internet. You know, find me something cool. Like today I want to do like a dark track, or I want to do an energetic track. And then they would just all go on like DeviantArt or Google Images or something. And then they'd send me an image. And then I found a lot of the images ended up being from the same guy, David Benzal. And so I messaged him and I was like, do you mind if I, you know, just have some of your art? You know, it was as blunt as that. Do you mind if I just, you know, borrow some of your art and write music to them? And, you know, he's a true artist. So, you know, like he was very open to collaboration. So he had all these pieces of music. He actually did the cover for Nomad.
Oh, wow.
You know, I was... So then what I was doing is having the chat room send me a piece of art, you know, from this guy. And I was responding very well to it. So a lot of them are actually based on the art. And that's what I was talking about in the last question about being a reactive composer, is that I would just look at those images and they are the thing that, you know, evokes the mood. They evoke the tone. practice for me. You know, like if I'm not actively on a project at a time, you know, I'm constantly working. I think that's important for all composers. Just keep writing music. And that's the best practice I'd had in a long time. I mean, at the time I was moving countries. That's why the album was actually called Nomad, because I was moving. I lived in Tokyo for 7 months. Then I was in England, then Hungary, and then America. And, you know, so I was moving around a lot. When I was in between locations, you know, I'd be writing bits of music because, you know, that was too chaotic to take on too much work at that time. Mm-hmm. So I would just write pieces of music to these images, and, you know, it turned into a whole thing. It was great practice, because now whenever a director sends me a piece of concept art or something, I'm so well versed in taking an image and then interpreting it into music that it's almost second nature now. It's like driving a car. You don't think about it when you do it, you know?
Yeah, no,
like
that's
me. Yeah, that's me when I look at a picture now. I look at it and I can feel it musically, so I don't have to think about writing music. It just kind of writes itself, which is great for me.
That is an amazing skill to have. It's so cool. Mm. And I've watched some of your live streams, and they are fascinating. Oh, yeah? They're just, it's
fascinating.
Like, no, they are, because I was a piano major in college, but I never had to actually write any music. And with all of the sample libraries that you have, and the new one with the strings and the brass, I think, well, hey, it's kind of like that public TV series. I don't know if you ever saw it, Painting with Bob Ross, where
I've heard of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just as he would just talk and paint. And by the end of the program, he'd have this really cool looking landscape. And I really admire how you can pull these musical ideas out of your head and talk at the same time.
I'm glad you said head there. Pulled them out of my head. Yes.
Yeah.
That's where they're all pulled from.
Of course they are.
I worked out, by the way, the other day. I worked out that I've gotten to a point now where I have 20 sample libraries with significant amount of strings. So I have 20 string libraries now. That is insane, Kate. That is too many string libraries. But then I like to think that, the cost of how much it would have cost to record all those libraries live, and then how much I paid for the sample libraries, you know, I think I made the right choice.
Well, what was so interesting, I thought, was the way you were playing with the attack of the strings to get it to sound the way you could get a big range from an actual violinist. It just was really fascinating. I mean, you could spend hours on it.
Yeah, that's one of the things I specifically do, and that happened in my career, is, like I mentioned, because I was crap at orchestral writing when I started my career, I started with sound design and synthesis, because they were something that I was more in tune with because of my band days, you know, like production, making records or whatever. So when I started composing, and Harry Gregson-Williams was a big influence on this, particularly the Man on Fire score, is a lot of the score isn't orchestra. It's just sound designs and weird textures and things like that. And I realized that I had a skill of doing that. So that's actually how I started. You know, I can do the big orchestral thing now, but, you know, that took a bit more work to do. So when it comes to when I'm playing with orchestral libraries, I use them the same way I would treat a sound design or a synthesizer. You know, like I treat them as a sound. I don't treat them as real people, which sounds really cruel, but I treat them as a sound, which I think in certain situations, you know, is in my benefit, you know, because not too many people, particularly people who are classically trained, or, you know, people who have worked with live players and such, they will probably find it harder to manipulate the live parts of their recordings more so than a sound design, you know. So like, if I have no issue whatsoever with taking like a double bass section and then pitching it down another octave and distorting it and then chopping it up, you know, that's I treat it as a sound as opposed to a person, whereas an orchestral composer would be like, oh no, you can't go down below this note, like that's the lowest string the note has. And I'm like, but you have a computer, you know, you can make it go further down, right? And they're like, yeah, but he would never play that live. And it's like, I know, but he's not playing live. He's in my computer. You know, that's the thing. I think, a lot of people, I mean, if you're getting the $1 million budget to record an orchestra live in LA or London, in Abbey Road or whatever, unless you're getting those kinds of budgets, you're going to be using some sort of sample sample based production anyway. Even if you record like in, you know, Eastern Europe, or even if you do get a London session, they can't, if you're doing like a big action film or something with lots of synths or something like this, you're going to be adding sample libraries of orchestra to that anyway, to bolster it, to make it bigger. Because we're so used to people like me messing it up for the natural guys, you know, we can take a string library and make it sound like, you know, 500 players or something, which, you know, is prohibitively expensive in the real world. So, you know, it's just part of the game now. And I find that because I expect to be using just samples all the time, I stop trying to treat them like real people. I don't have the budget, or I don't have the means to, you know, record live players. If I did, I would compose the piece in a completely different way. You know, I wouldn't be as unrealistic with it. But the fact that it samples means I can do whatever I want with the sound. I can go in any direction. I can manipulate anything, any way. I can have 400 brass players because I have that ability. If it sounds good, it's right. If it sounds crap, then absolutely not. Then, you know, get rid of it. That's what it boils down to. If it sounds good, it's good. If it sounds bad, it's bad. It doesn't matter if it sounds real. It doesn't matter if a real person couldn't do it. If it sounds good, that's all that the director's going to hear. He'll be like, that's either good or it's bad. The directors tend not to sit there and go, yeah, but the double bass can't go down that low, or are you sure the French horn player can go up that high? It's like, it doesn't matter. It's all about being good or bad.
Well,
sorry, I'm very philosophical this morning. I've had lots of coffee.
Well, and honestly, you know, all the samples in the world aren't going to help you if you're not a good composer to start with, because
right.
Then you know what's going to work, or how you can, like you say, manipulate the sound so that it works in the film. And that's got to be tough, though, when you've got like millions of colors to play with, to kind of narrow it down and, you know, figure out what the starting point is and what the palette basically is for a particular project.
That's actually it's an interesting thing. I mean, as a sample composer, a skill that I think is often overlooked is actually knowing your libraries. like you see, I think it was Junkie XL put a video up on YouTube, and he had what was it? It was something like 2,000 tracks or something already preloaded, ready to go in his template. That almost gave me an anxiety attack just looking at it. The way I do it is I have like my session set up with just empty instances of Kontakt, and I load things as I go, you know, because I know I have such like, I sound like I'm bigging myself up, but like I have such like an intricate knowledge of all the libraries I have because I've used them for so long, you know, and I know which libraries do what well and what they fail at, because very rarely does a library do everything well. That's why I have 20 string libraries, you know, like one library may only do harmonics well and everything else is crap or something like that. But when I need harmonics, I know that I have it.
Yeah.
So I like you say, like having too many colors to play with sounds like it could be a problem. But again, going back to what I was saying with like how I treat the orchestra as a sound, I treat the sections as a sound. So strings is only one sound to me, if that makes sense. Like, so I never worry about having 20 string libraries. Because strings, when it comes down to it, even in my mix setup, you know, like I just have strings bounce down to a group bus of strings, and I manipulate it and I edit it and I mix it as one tone. So, you know, I only have strings, brass, percussion, woodwinds, and then like synths, you know, so there's only really five things I'm ever thinking about. And when it comes to sound design, what sometimes I'll, you know, if I'm feeling particularly mischievous that day, I'll just go into my like vast custom sample bank, you know, because I make a lot of loops and things in projects, and then I render them out, remanipulate them. So I have just hundreds and thousands of like random loops and things. Sometimes I'll just drag in a sound. I won't audition it. I just drag it in and then make it work because then I'm forced to be creative. You know, if it doesn't work initially, I know that I can make it work. So I often find that like that's a good way to you know, kickstart my creativity for the day, is, you know, just pull stuff in. So it doesn't matter how many of them I have. I know that I can make the track work because, like I say, if you break it down enough that you know what the tone and the texture is going to be, like I said at the beginning with your subconscious, it will tell you whether or not what you're hearing is right or wrong. You know, and then you just manipulate it till it stops sounding shit and starts sounding good. Sorry, beep. Till it starts sounding good. Yeah.
Well, you've also mentioned that one of the things you take into consideration when you're scoring a game is kind of the rhythm of the action. And uh-huh. So is that like a place where you start with kind of breaking down, you know, how the players are moving to kind of give you a sense of what the rhythm of the music should be?
Yeah, it's a lot easier to do in film. Because when people are moving around, it's a set kind of tempo, you know, so you could, if you wanted to, even look at their steps and subdivide it and see, you know, what tempo they're running at, if you wanted to be that, you know, particular about it. But yeah, so like rhythm, like I'm what we call affectionately in the industry, a perk whore. I love percussion. So, you know, rhythm is always a place I'll tend to start if I have the opportunity to. It's so tribal, you know, like percussion's like the first instrument we ever had. You know, even when you're walking, if your feet start to make a cool rhythm, you know, like you'll pick up on it. It's just something inherent within humans. We love rhythm. So yeah, when I'm starting like a movie scene or something, finding tempo is always the most important thing, like the speed of the actual scene. In video games, it's a lot more complex because you never quite know what the player's going to do at any given moment.
Yeah, because you can walk or run or crouch or just look around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have to, that's a conversation that you have to have with your audio director. Like having specific sets of music for different scenarios is the only real way of doing it, or dynamic music, you know, for instance. So like you know, in the game I'm working on at the minute, you know, we have a lot of like stinger based concepts, you know, so if something happens in the game, it's an esport game. It is actually really fun. But yeah, so like if something happens, then you have a bit of music which sets up, which will feel correct for the given situation, you know, so we can predetermine like something just happened in the game and, you know, it's going to be happening for like the next minute or so. So we can play a cue that's almost bespokely tailored to that scenario, you know, so we go through and we decide what situations could happen, and then there's some wizard programmer that figures out a way of telling the game well, telling the engine that that's actually happening right now. And then we can cue up the, you know, the right piece of music. But another fun thing I do with rhythm is on Metal Gear, I did the, you know, Metal Gear Online. So the main Metal Gear Solid 5 had a multiplayer mode, which was almost like its own game. And it required its own main theme, which I got to write, which was insane because, like, I if I remember correctly, it was like, we need it to be as memorable as Harry Gregson Williams, you know, Metal Gear Solid 2 theme. And
no like, pressure, oh, though, Jesus. Right?
Oh, no. Yeah. Like, if they say we want it to be the most, you know, we want it to be original and people love it and all that, that would have been just, you know, run of the mill. Okay, I can deal with that pressure. But make it as good as Harry Gregson Williams and make it as memorable, you know, something I grew up with. I'm like, ah, no. So the way I actually did it is I do this quite a lot. And if I tell you it, you'll not be able to unhear it. So I apologize. But like I mentioned, rhythm is so intrinsically human. It's the first instrument we ever had, right? So we understand rhythm even if we don't realize that we understand it. So in Metal Gear Online, there's this in the theme, there's this undercurrent of a rhythm that goes dun da 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 dun da 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 dun, right? And I very specifically chose that rhythm because it goes dun Metal Gear Online. You know, it's the correct amount of syllables to say Metal Gear Online, like. Duh, duh. You know, so when you hear it, you kind of subconsciously hear the name of the game. And there's a few good examples, you know, like Superman. Da da da, you know, it says Superman. You know? And
that's
you're
brilliant.
Finding, if you can subconsciously drop in this, if you can drop in the name of the game into the rhythm, you'll find that you kind of subconsciously understand it as a rhythm. And that's why you often hear big differences in the way a melody sounds from an English speaking composer, from like a Japanese composer, because the Japanese language is very different. When you speak it, you know, the rhythm is very different. And you'll find that melodies often represent the language of the composer who's writing it. So, you know, English has a certain rhythm to the way we talk, and we have certain cadences. You know, we sometimes, particularly in LA, we go up at the end of a sentence, you know, even when we don't need to, like it's a question. You know, and you'll find that the rhythm of the melodies tend to, you know, reflect how you speak. So in Japanese, you know, I can't speak Japanese other than to say Nihongo hanasemasen, you know, da 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 da. You know, like you get a lot, it's a lot faster and a lot more kind of, it's a lot more divisible.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot more syllables in Japanese. So if you listen to Japanese melodies and stuff, you often hear a lot more kind of notes in a given line, you know, in a given bar, you'll find more notes because it represents how they speak. And because melody is, you know, something that's, that kind of comes from singing. The best melodies are the ones you remember. You'll find that you could easily sing.
Yeah, I think you know, might have just completely nailed why the music from the Final Fantasy games sounds different from music by Western composers. And wow, that's so cool.
Yeah, it really, you'll notice it more. Mm-hmm, that like,
yeah.
So what depending on where the composer's from, it'll have like a, that's why French composers sound a bit French, you know, it's a bit more relaxed, a bit more kind of soft on the edges, because that's how the language works.
Yeah.
English is just very aggressive and, you know, loud and obnoxious.
Very four square, yeah. So what did you just say in Japanese?
Nihongo hanasemasen. I don't speak Japanese.
Oh.
Yeah, I lived there for 7 months. The only thing I picked up was Igo ga hanasemasu ka, which is, do you speak English? And then if they say no, I say sumimasen, which is like, sorry, Nihongo hanasemasen. You know, I don't speak Japanese. And then what would follow is like awkward body language, you know.
Yep.
Koryo, like I'd point at things like this. Koryo, itatsu, you know.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, my Japanese wasn't very good.
Oh, well.
which was actually like lucky, like worth mentioning on Metal Gear. I did actually work with a couple of other people. So Harry Gregson-Williams obviously was the score producer, and then we had Justin Burnett, who was the music by, and then Ludwig Forssell,
right? Yeah,
who was the in-house composer at Kojima Productions. And it's worth mentioning that, like, talking about like luck, particularly like a lot of composing is luck. He is multilingual. He's Swedish, but he lives in Japan, so he speaks Swedish and Japanese, but he also speaks English.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason I got that job is because him being like the audio director for the game, you know, the in-house guy, they were able to work with English-speaking people because I don't speak Japanese. Had he not been there, you know, I probably wouldn't have got that gig.
Wow.
You know, would have gone to somebody who speaks Japanese. So, you know, I got very lucky there, and just a shout out to Ludwig there, you know, because that was lucky. Yeah. And fortunate on my behalf.
Yeah. Well, he was at GDC too. I had a quick chance to say hi to him. And that just kind of illustrates, I guess, what a close-knit community composers for games are. I mean, we're talking now because we're both friends with Jason Graves. And why do you think that is, that the merry band of game composers is so tight?
I think, first of all, there's just not many of us that do it. So, you know, it's kind of a niche industry anyway. I mean, you get a lot of people, but one of the things is that I think musicians being artists, that there's, you know, there's a healthy competition between us. But at the end of the day, we all kind of want to just help each other. You know, it's an artistic endeavor. You know, we all kind of want to share what we're doing and, you know, take a look at what everyone else is doing and get advice and tips. And, you know, you tend to find that musicians follow like the golden rule of networking, which is don't be a dick. Like, you'll find that if you want to get somewhere in life, not being a dick helps. I mean, there are industries where, you know, like the most vicious, you know, the strongest rise to the top and all, you know. But in music, as an artistic thing, it just doesn't work that way. Like, you'll find the people who are nice, genuine people, the people who want to help, it's very karma driven, I find, this industry, is that like the nicer and the more helpful you are in a genuine way, not in a ulterior motive way. The more genuine you are, the more successful you seem to be. I'm not sure why it works that way, but it's like everybody just wants to, like, the people who are successful, you'll find, are the people who just want to help and want to share and want to bring people in and teach people things. It's a very collaborative industry to be in. I mean, I couldn't tell you why exactly, but like I know from my experience that like the golden rule of networking has been abided by in the most successful of people. And I'm sure you find that too.
Oh, Dave, right? Everybody I've talked to, they just could not be nicer. And I'll mention the name of a composer and they'll be like, oh yeah, I know him. So <Yeah. laughs> it's really, really been a lot of fun to get everybody's kind of, everybody comes to this from a different path, but ultimately, you know, they're here for the love of just doing it, which I think is really cool.
So. Yeah. And you'll find that it all comes down to, as well, it's one of those industries where, you know, you can go to school for music, but that'll only help you so much. It's cool in that you can kind of, so long as it sounds good, it doesn't matter what you do to get to the end result. So it's a much more open industry to anybody from anywhere, from any walk of life, to have a swing at it, if that makes sense. You know, I was, when I was working on Metal Gear, you know, I was working out of my tiny little bungalow in England, you know, completely devoid, completely detached from Japan. But, you know, we have the internet now, and that's, you know, something we can't understate, you know, how important the internet is these days. You know, as a composer, if you love it, you know, if you like it, if you want to work in the music industry, you can just do it now. Like I said, I worked on Metal Gear from a tiny little village in England, you know, like back in the day, that would have been impossible.
Yeah.
But and that also helped, you know, that also is one of the things that brings people together, you know, how fortunate we all are. The nicer people rise to the top, you know, because that's the kind of industry, that's the kind of community people want to be a part of. I don't understand anybody who wants to be part of a community of assholes, you know, like it doesn't make sense to me. So like, and you'll find that they're the ones who get the work, and then they recommend their friends. I mean, like a lot of, like I'm very fortunate, you know, like a lot of my gigs have come off the back of people I know. I mean, I worked on Metal Gear with Ludwig, who I met online, worked on Call of Duty Black Ops with Jack Wall, you know, someone I met through, you know, through Facebook and my live streams, you know, Terminator with Lorne Balfe, you know, because I like Hans Zimmer once saw a video I did. So we ended up talking about it, I ended up interning where I got to meet Lorne, you know, like yeah. It's all through people you meet. And, the music industry is definitely one of those industries where it's not what you know, it's who you know. Like there's a bar of music where you have to be good enough to do the job. But beyond that point, it's more about who you are as a person and who you know as a person,
yeah.
Which is, which can be good or bad depending on how much of a dick you are.
Wow. Daniel, it has been so much fun talking with you. I mean, we could just like go on and on and on, but I'm sure we'll catch up again.
If you don't stop me, Kate, I will if you don't.
But I'm sure we'll have a chance to catch up again. And I really want to thank you for spending some time. It's been great.
Well, thank you for having me.